And for some crazy reason, the first couple echoes didn't record well on the first couple sections because of this weird screen. So I'm actually going to record these, this one, all the way through to make sure it gets on there. Okay, so hopefully we can go through this. And then we'll go through kind of the content, and then we'll go over any questions that you have. Right. So hopefully it won't be so bad. And where are we? We're in circulation. And what do we want to do? Okay. So to make sure that we're all on the same page and we're covering the same content for all your sections, right? Let's quickly go through this. Do you remember where we are with this? Action potential. Where is this taking place? Anybody remember? Where does this happen? Where does this being recorded from?
Ventricle. The heart.
The heart, but?
Ventricle.
Ventricular muscle, right? So very important to remember which tissue cell type that you're in. And this is a standardized type of test question on MCATs, DSAT, pharmacy exams right here. And I don't know why they just show usually this figure, because it depends where you record in the heart, right? And we've even had people in the Kaplan that were tutors for it. We had a student in the class that, you know, was a tutor even his second year in med school, and they said even the Kaplan kind of messed it up on some of their books because they just kind of give you that broad term. And we'll go through this, why this is an issue. But why is this shown all the time? It's because of this plateau phase. And usually the question comes up, oh, what's responsible for the plateau and the action potential in the heart? Well, it depends which tissue you're in for that. But the answer, the quick answer to this is the calcium, right? It's a long calcium influx that makes rise to this plateau. So look at this response here. This is 250 milliseconds, right? Action potential in nerve is usually, what, 1 to 2 milliseconds. But in the nerve terminal, at a motor nerve terminal, what's the shape of the action potential? No one's got that $100 yet, right? Okay, so... remember, they haven't had that recorded yet in a mammalian neuromuscular junction because it's by inference like an invertebrate, like your favorite preparation, which is crayfish, of course, right? But the point here is that what gives rise to the upstroke on this ventricular action potential? Sodium, right? So sodium fluxing in. And then you have, just like the action potential that we've covered in the nervous system, opening up voltage-gated potassium channels, but like in the nerve terminal, there are other channels there, which are voltage-gated calcium channels. These are long-lasting. They open up and last for a long time, so a lot of calcium dumps into the heart cell. What's that calcium going to do in the heart cell? Why do we have such a long action potential? Ventricular muscle cell. That's the key. Ventricular muscle. Why is it? Why do we have such a long action potential?
It allows it to fill. And contract for longer?
Allowing it to contract for a long period of time, because what do you want to do with that ventricle? You really want to contract and pump it out, right? So a strong, long contraction, get that ventricle pumping out the blood. Okay, and then it's what opened up those, voltage-gated sodium channels will start to close. Calcium starts to inactivate, close down. The potassium's taking over, and it comes back down and repolarizes. Now, why are we emphasizing this? Because it can be confusing with this other figure. If we go back, right here. Right? Now, where is this? This is a pacemaker potential, right? This is in your SA node, or, you know, high up on the atrium. And this changes, right? This is like very different. So what's due... what causes the depolarization here for this pacemaking cell? It's interesting because we're at a low value. It's not really a resting membrane potential because pacemaking cells don't have really a resting membrane potential. They're pacing all the time, right? But the low value actually opens up a sodium channel, right? And that's why this is called a funny sodium channel, because it's open at a low negative value, right? So this is actually flowing. This channel opens at a low value. And so sodium's going to go in. Well, sodium goes in. What's it going to do? slightly depolarize it, and then you have two types of calcium channels. You have a transient calcium channel and a long-lasting calcium channel. So the transient one means transient, short period of time. So what's going to happen if it opens? It's voltage sensitive. Boom, it opens. Calcium's going to flow in, right? And it's going to flow in and then depolarize it more. So the T is transient. The L is long duration or long lasting. And then you get the upstroke, a lot to do with calcium, really, right? But what was the initial depolarization here? This is the funny sodium channel, okay? So sometimes that has been separated out on standardized exams, but the last time it was mostly just this on the Kaplan stuff, was just on the long plateau phase of the action potential and the ventricular muscle. But now let's look what happens. So the calcium channel's open, you depolarize a lot more, then what happens? Voltage-gated potassium channel's open, and that's going to counteract that calcium influx, and then we start to come back down, and then it comes back to a negative value, and then what happens? Oh, now the funny channel starts to open again. And then when the funny channel opens, it starts to depolarize, and the whole thing goes over and over again, right? So I know it's a little bit like, ooh, but if you just separate out the ventricular muscle pretty much from the pacemaking potential, you got it down, right? But try to remember that there's some differences between these two. Okay, so we've already talked about why we get all that calcium in there. What's that calcium going to do when it gets inside the heart? Muscle cell? Skeletal muscle? What's it going to do? What does it bind to? Troponin C, right? Troponin C. What does that do? Conformational change. Exposes the active site on what? Myosin or actin? Actin, the myosin's waiting there, boom, contraction, right? And then if the calcium's still there because of a lot of calcium coming in, what's it going to do? The head comes back, comes off only by what? How's the head going to come off the active site? ATP, right? And then if there's still active sites exposed, binds again, keeps contracting, right? What stops the whole contraction process? What started it? What allowed the myosin heads to bind? Calcium. So what do we have to do? We have to hide that active site. So we've got to get that calcium back into the SCR, back out of the cytoplasm, right? And then the head, even though they come off, there's nothing to attach to, it can relax, right? So just kind of review and think of that whole process that you're looking through. So this is this whole idea that we've just talked about. And as you can imagine then, the action potential in the ventricle, well, we're going to get contraction a little bit later, right? So the contractile response occurs after that electrical event. Okay, so when we talk about the EKG trace that you've had that lab, we should be familiar enough with this. You know, what does it mean? So let's just go through this. What's the P wave?
Atrial depolarization.
Atrial depolarization, great. And a P to the Q, what does that represent?
The lag.
Pardon? Depolarization is the P wave. Not so much repolarization yet.
The lag in the AV node?
The lag in the AV node is the primary point here, right? Because what's happening? We depolarize the atria, and then where did it have to go? It had to go through the AV node, because what's the QRS? The QRS is ventricular muscle contracting, right? So how did we get down to the ventricle? We had to go through the AV node, bundle of His, Purkinje cells, finally to the ventricle muscle, right? So where's the biggest delay right there is the AV node. Remember, that's what causes the delay in the electrical response to the ventricular muscle. This is where a sympathetic nervous system can actually speed up the heart, because it shortens the delay in the AV node. There's actually a delay in the electrical signal. I know that's hard to think about, because you think electrical signals are always made to go fast, 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 right? But here we actually slow it down so the atria have time to contract, push blood into the ventricle, and then you want the ventricle to contract, right? So this is really a slowing down. This P to Q is a slowing down. Now, if you go back to here, we have these listed out here, the PR segment really expresses a lot to the AV node delay. ST segment plateau phase is in there too, right, for the ventricular muscle depolarization, the TP ventricular filling. Now, I know these segments and stuff is a little bit hard to remember. Hopefully, we can go through a little bit of this to make it easier. And this has appeared on standardized exams too, so I want you to not to miss any of these kind of things if you take a test on this later, or just for in here. So how to remember this where you won't forget it? I know I try corny things, but here's another corny one. So think of left to the right of the QRS, okay? And these intervals and segments have appeared on standardized exams, and like people are like, what's the difference between an interval and a segment? I'm so confused, you know? Well, the interval includes one of the waves. But which wave? So how to know this down where you don't just have to memorize, but kind of think about it. To the left of the QRS, it includes the first part of the interval, P to R. See, P to R. On the right side of the QRS, it includes the second letter. So we get this S to T interval. You see, it doesn't include the S. It's trying to confuse you, right? But it includes the T. But look at the QRS interval. It includes the QRS completely. So left side, the first letter. Middle, both, everything. Right side, the far right letter. Okay? And then you won't forget it for intervals. Right? Now you got it for standardized tests. One more question you got right on your DSET or MCAT test. Okay, but some other waves that we haven't talked about probably, and you maybe didn't get it in the lab. The U wave. You can see the U wave in some recordings. It's not talked about that much, but it can appear too. So, kind of a misnomer sometimes. P wave is atrial depolarization. QRS is ventricular depolarization. T wave is?
Ventricular hyperpolarization.
Not hyper. Not depolarization. Repolarization. Okay, so where's the peak? Where's the atrial repolarization?
It's hidden by the QRS.
It's what? Yeah, they usually say it's hidden in the textbooks, but it's hidden, it's buried under the QRS. But, you know, if you have an arrhythmia, or you have a blockage, let's say a block in your bundle of His or your AV node, and you get P-wave, P-wave, QRS, and we don't have to go over the blocks, but, you know, it's kind of interesting. If you had P-wave, and then a QRS, because you've got a block here and they're working separately, you really don't see a repolarization of the atria in those waves. So you see where it's kind of a misconception in a bit, but still people have that in textbooks, that there's a repolarization, but it really is not there because it's too small to really detect at any times. Okay, so it's kind of interesting to think about. This table is just there for your own benefit, but to kind of, you know, not to memorize everything are the times, but to understand what we mentioned, just what we went over, basically, right? Okay. This is kind of interesting, the sounds. So if you listen to the heart, something to do, you know, when you're crying on your significant other's shoulder after the exam. No, I'm joking. So you can listen to the heart sounds, and they're really quite interesting. But the main ones that we've heard of are like the jaws, right? Lum dum lum dum. But what do these represent? Lub dub, lub dub. What's lub refer to? So the atria contract of valves. So which valves? Yeah, and tricuspid. So both sides of the heart are working together, so we've got to remember they're both valves. It sometimes has been tricky kind of questions in past exams. Oh, just as a side note then, remember that when we had open response questions with the heart, people used to write, well, the right heart works first, and then the left heart then depolarizes, and then that pumps. But that's not the way it works, right? They're both sides are working together, right? Both atria contracting, pushing the blood into the ventricles, both ventricles contracting, getting blood out. So this is all at the same time. So how to remember love dub? Great about these valves. So love, think about it this way. Love and dub. And if you think love and dub, right? And you just keep that in your mind, this kind of mode of command. Love and dub. Don't get it backwards. But love is, the ventricles are contracting. What are they closing? The AV valves, right? The tricuspid and bicuspid valves. You don't want blood going back into the atrium. So those close. That's the first sound, love. And then what's dub? Well, the ventricles contract. They push blood into the what? Pulmonary artery and the aorta. And now what's happening? Blood's going. The ventricles are going to relax. Where's the blood going to go now? It's going to backflow, you know, a little bit, right? and from the pulmonary artery and the aortic, and it's going to close those two valves. Right? It's going to close the aortic valve, and it's going to close the pulmonary artery valve. So that's the dub. So love, I mean, love, dub, right? Love, dub, right? So you can try to remember that. And if you heard odd sounds like love, swish, dub, what does that represent? Love, swish, dub. Love, swish, dub. What would you think? Love. That's right. The AV valves are leaky, right? Blood's going back up into the AV valves. And why could that happen? The chorda tendae maybe broke loose, or maybe had a little infarct where the chorda tendae were attached down at the bottom of the ventricle, and they're loose, right? And now the valves go backwards into the atrium, and blood goes back into the atrium. What if you heard love, dub, swish? Love, dub, swish. Now we're talking about the aortic valve and the pulmonary artery valve, right? Love, dub, swish. Right, love, dub, swish. So the sounds are fantastic. You can tell so much about the heart. I think the heart stuff is so interesting because there's so many things that you can get from an EKG or just listening to the heart that's really quite amazing. Now, we went over the EKG in class yesterday, some of it, right? On those waves like Salvador Dali, the spike T wave or the shapes in it, the ST segment that could be raised, shows like a myocardial infarction. Actually, even head trauma, traumatic brain injury can show a altered EKG trace. So it's the first kind of, you know, really quick assessment that just takes a few minutes to collect, and you can tell so much about it, right? So it's really quite amazing. But what are these sounds then? Sound love, dub. What are sound 3 and 4? I won't test you on that, but just that you've heard that there are sounds 3 and 4. Those are like the fourth sound, third sound, is atrial filling. And in some cases, it's normal. It depends if, like, if you're a strong athlete or maybe an infant. And so we can talk a little bit about that. So generally, sound 1 and sound 2 we should know about pretty well. Not so common, but in young children, you can maybe hear it. In neonates, you don't really hear 3 and 4. I think on your PowerPoints online when you downloaded them, that this part was kind of like below your PowerPoint. You had to move it up. So there it is. Hey, but Kentucky's known for something. Look at that. Internationally, we are recognized in textbooks internationally for the sound of Kentucky. If you hear the three sounds. And Tennessee is actually known too. Now if you put it on the map, people try to figure out where it is. But if you hear the fourth sound, people actually say, oh, I hear Tennessee. Oh, I hear Kentucky. And that may be what are they referring to. Don't you think that it relates to they hear your accent or something crazy, you know? So they're hearing this. Okay, so this is really kind of interesting. But we're not going to worry about S3 and S4. I just want you to be aware that that might happen. So back to that first shape of the action potential. When we talk about, you saw that trace, like ventricular muscle, commonly used in standardized exams and things. But really, it depends which muscle, which cell type you're in, the shape of the action potential. And you can see that the delay is the delay that it takes to get down to the ventricle muscle from the SA node to the ventricle, right? So all that's important to kind of watch out for. So SA, you know, atria, AV, bundle of His, Purkinje fibers. And we kind of remember that the pacing, remember we talked about how... What's your heart rate normally? Except for tomorrow morning at 9:30. Yeah, around 70 beats a minute, right? And that's run from your SA node, right? And remember, if you damage your SA node, the AV node takes over, right? A slower rate, maybe about 50 to 60. If that's damaged, then the bundle of His takes over, right? And that could be around 50 to 40. And if the bundle of His is damaged, what takes over? The Purkinje fibers. And that can be around 40 to or lower to 20 beats per minute. So there's a lot of redundancy to protect the heart to keep it beating. It's really neat that the master pacemaker and then on the way down. Okay, so you know you can record EKG in all kinds of animals. It's really quite fun. In fish, horses, dogs. And if you look up EKG, if you're interested in it, if you do the Wikipedia stuff, you'll find that probably the first... the recordings were done in Germany with a dog. I think the dog's name was Baxter or something like that. And they put their feet into saline buckets, basically, and recorded the EKG traces, and then they began to understand a lot more about it. Okay, so we do know systole is contraction, right? The contractile phase, and distole is the relaxation phase, just to remember. And if we look at this trace about the... This is just for your information, kind of on the PowerPoint, to have it all complete in these numbers. But really, let's just go to this. And if we look at the electrical events, what's happening, you know, when, but this one's really the one to focus on. And if you drew this out on a blank piece of paper, then you've got it down, right, if you can go through this. How to actually go through this? Start off with the EKG traces at the very top. That might be the easiest, right? The atrial depolarization. Well, what's going to happen with atrial depolarization? Well, the atria depolarize, they contract. So what's going to happen to atrial pressure? Atrial pressure is going to build up, this green line right here, right? And then what happens with that? That pushes blood into the ventricles, right? So now, and then the ventricles are going to depolarize, the QRS complex, and then what happens? The ventricles contract, boom, love, the sound, love, right? And then if the ventricles are contracting and the valve is closed, AV valve, remember the pulmonary artery valve and the aortic valve are not open yet, right? So what's happening to the ventricles? They are contracting, the valves are closed, so does volume change? All the valves are closed. So there's no blood going in, there's no blood going out. So the volume isn't changing. So what do we call this? And this has been on standardized exams too, and some students said, I forgot all about that thing, so I'll make an emphasis again. This is referred to isovolumetric contraction. Iso, the same, volumetric, volume, contraction. So isovolumetric contraction during this phase. But what happens if you take a balloon that's sealed off and you squeeze it? What's going to happen to the pressure in there? It's going to go way up, right? So look at the pressure wave in the ventricle, the red line. It's going way up. But the volume is not changing at all. The volume is isovolumetric. Volume. It's isovolumetric. But the pressure is going way up. Now, can you get a low pressure system going into a high pressure? Was water going to flow from low pressure to high pressure? No. So another kind of trick question that has appeared on exams before is that, oh, then the pressure must be higher in the aorta than it is the ventricle to get blood to move in, right, into the aorta. But no. So look at the top of that figure. What's happening at 12 right here? The ventricle is contracting, pressure's building up, and that blue line is coming down. What's happening right there? The pressure has finally exceeded, and this is the left side of the heart, pressure waves. Okay. Let me just back up a second. Usually you see some textbooks, this one I've been used right here, or figures, you'll see this pressure wave for the left side. Think of all of this mimicking on the right side. What would that look like? Lower pressures, right? So we're talking about pulmonary artery pressure, which is much lower. The right side of the heart is weaker, right? When we showed you those hearts in the outreach center. So all these pressure waves are lower on the right side and in the pulmonary artery. But it's the same general diagram. I don't want you to have to memorize the pressures generally, just the main concept, because you can put that in. You know your blood pressure. 120 over 70 generally should be. So 120 is systole, right? 70 is diastole, right? So that's the lower one. So what's happening right at 12? The ventricles are contracting. We've already closed the AV valves right here, right? So this is love. Ventricles contract and they finally exceed the pressure in the pulmonary artery or in the aorta, in this case, the aorta. So the aorta opens at 12, right? And now blood's going into the aorta. And here's where it gets confusing. So the pressure in the aorta is higher or lower than the ventricle. The blood's now going to go into the aorta. The pressure still has to be higher in the ventricle, right, to get blood to go into the aorta, right? It can't be higher. The aorta can't be higher. So now you still see that red line that's above the blue line up there at the top? That means the ventricle pressure is higher than the aorta. Blood's going into the aorta. Finally, the ventricle is going to relax. And when the ventricle relaxes, what's going to happen at 18? The ventricle's relaxing. Blood was going to the aorta, but now blood comes back. Boom, love, dub, right? The aortic valve is closed, and now the ventricle can relax, But the aortic valve's closed, but so is the AV valve. So what do we have right here? We have two valves closed and the ventricle's relaxing. So what does this refer to? Isovolumetric relaxation, right? Isovolumetric relaxation during that phase of all the valves are closed. What's happening up there at 18? And I don't know why they still appear in standardized exams, but they make a deal about it. If you were able to catheterize somebody like a femoral artery and go all the way up with a pressure transducer and get right next to the aortic valves, you would see that little notch. It's called the dicrotic notch. And it appears in standardized exams. It's just there. And what does that do to? That's due to that backflow, boom, closing the aortic valve, and you get that little pressure wave. It kind of shows that the aortic valve is really closed really nicely, and you're not, you know, having that lub-dub swish, right? If you had a small dicrotic notch and you had lub-dub swish, you probably wouldn't see a very prominent dicrotic notch, right? Because the blood flow is going back into the ventricles. So it's kind of neat, relating to the sound. And then what happens? Ventricular volume drops. What happens right here? Well, it becomes lower than the atrial pressure. So what's going to open? The AV valve. If we're on the left side, that's the bicuspid, right? So now fluid flows back into the ventricle, right? And you see the ventricle filling. But this little push right here, ventricular volume right here, why is that jumping up like it did right here? Well, the atrial contract, right? And they push the blood into the ventricle, so you get more blood in there, priming that pump, ready for the big pump, ready for the big, swoosh. Right? So kind of go through this and, be familiar enough. I think the easiest way to do this is to take that blank piece of paper, see where you can go with it. See that you could draw it out. And I haven't made the test yet, but, I think this would be really neat things to put in there. Some of this, right? Because it is a major part of your heart. And you had a lab on it too, so it's kind of bringing the lab into the aspect. Okay. All right. So we've talked about this. Just make sure that you've heard about isovolumetrics too. Okay. And a common output is cardiac output. So when we talk about cardiac output, that's the amount of blood per time, right? So the amount of blood of volume per time, per minute. And what is your heart output? About 5 liters a minute, right? Until you take the exam, and it speeds up. Or you start to exercise, what happens to your cardiac output? It's going to go up. But why does it go up? What's the cause of it? Is it more blood, or is it the rate? It's really both. So cardiac output is heart rate times stroke volume. Stroke volume is how much blood goes out with every stroke, right? But let's say you're going so fast. Let's say you have ventricular fibrillation, like your ventricles are spastic. You had some damage, and they're beating so fast. If they beat so fast, they don't have time to relax to fill, so your stroke volume is going down to almost nothing, but your heart rate's really high. And cardiac output goes to nothing almost too, right? So this is why you die. You can die really quickly with a ventricular fibrillation because the heart's beating too fast. You can't get any blood out, even though it's beating really fast, right? So that's kind of interesting to think about. Cardiac output, heart rate times stroke volume. Okay. And is cardiac output any different on the right side and left side of the heart? I mean, left side's a bigger heart, right? Bigger side. right side's kind of small. So is cardiac output bigger on the left side? Is there more blood coming out per minute on the left side of the heart than the right side? No, not at all, right? Trick kind of question. I mean, it seems not really tricky, but it conceptually sometimes you get it wrong because if you think the heart is smaller on the right side, but it has to be the same rate. Okay, so speeding up or slowing down the heart, as we talked about, sympathetic and parasympathetic innervation. How does the parasympathetic slow down the heart primarily?
It releases acetylcholine.
On what?
On the, it goes through the SA node into the AV node.
Right, so it's slowing down the pacemaker potential on the SA node. Primarily, it's chronotropic, slowing down the rate. Chron time, chronotropic. Now, how does the sympathetic speed up the heart?
The nerves innervate with the right? Left atria.
So it innervates the atria. And it releases epinephrine. And it also innervates the ventricular muscle. It does two things, but it also innervates that special node that we talked about, the AV node, to increase the speed of conduction through the AV node. Remember, the AV node is normally slowing down heart rate. But if you can speed up that conduction, it activates channels, so it repolarizes quickly, so it comes out. I don't want you to have to know the nitty-gritty details of the ion channels, but the idea is that it speeds up contraction through the AV node, and now you can speed up the heart. But it has that other function like you're mentioning. It can do something to the atria in the ventricle. It can enhance the contractility of the ventricle muscle by the epinephrine release. So it is inotropic as well as chronotropic. So inotropic is the contractility, and chronotropic is the rate. So it speeds up the rate as well as the strength of the heart to contract. So it's both chronotropic and inotropic.
What did you say in regards to the sympathetic system and the AV node?
The sympathetic system speeds up the conduction through the AV node.
Not through the SA node?
Well, the SA node is your pacemaker potential. It speeds up the pacing, but the main part is that you want it to enhance together. You don't want the slowing down. If you just fed up the SA node, you're beating faster, but you still have that delay in the AV node. So you need to speed up the conduction in the AV node. All right, so that's kind of cool. And this is where we have this point that we've been talking about. Enhances contractility, too, of the muscle fibers itself. Okay, so that's kind of neat to think about. Oh, the point here, too, let's review a little bit. So remember we talked about in the atria, there's something really amazing about the atria. If it gets stretched, what does it release? The atria. ANP, atrial natriuretic peptide, that's back to your endocrine chapter, right? And what does it do? Works on the kidneys to cause increased diuresis, increased urine production, to reduce blood pressure. Now, the ventricle has something unusual, too. If you stretch the ventricles, they will actually have a stronger contraction than in that beat. So this is what's referred to as the Frank-Starling principle. And this appears on standardized types of tests, too. So just, you know, you hear it by the name. I don't, you know, people like to memorize names. I hate this kind of just memorizing. But the point is that Frank-Starling principle is a well-known principle almost in all mammals that it's been looked at, as far as I know, every mammal that has been investigated. But the Frank-Starling law is that ventricle that stretches will have a stronger contraction. So what does it do? It prevents blood from building up in the ventricle. It prevents any residual volume from building up over time, so it can actually keep that blood going out and get out the pulmonary artery or aorta. Alright, so Frank Starling principle. Then you kind of just, these figures are kind of fun just to look at and make sure that you understand how these things, you know, work together to change heart rate or stroke volume, which then affects cardiac output, right? Again, heart rate times stroke volume. Okay, and we've talked about the coronary blood flow. Remember the coronary artery? Well, I should have shown you that. I don't remember if this lab section I did or not. In the hearts, when we were over at the outreach center, you could see those hearts, remember? If we looked in the aorta, right after the flaps in the aorta, so where the flaps open up, right there, kind of behind the flap, is where the blood vessel comes off of the coronary arteries. It's really quite cool because it's right there, and then it feeds out to the coronary, to the whole heart, right? The coronary arteries are really quite amazing, too, because the way they go across the whole heart. What's the other point we want to make there? Oh, that there's local control in the coronary arteries. So actually, if the coronary arteries or the tissue around it senses a low oxygen content, guess what happens? This adenosine is released. And adenosine will actually cause vasodilation of the coronary arteries. It's really quite cool to increase the blood flow. That's kind of neat, right? And then we saw some of those hearts that had a lot of that white stuff around it, the fat that was around those, and those are not great because those little tiny coronary arteries can clog up. And I don't remember if we showed you, but remember the aorta, we talked about the aorta is so thick, right? Because it's a high pressure system and there's muscle in there to keep it from popping, but in that it's so thick that it doesn't get its oxygenation from the blood going through the aorta. There's actually capillary beds within the wall of the aorta. So think of those fine little capillary beds that are in there. If they start to clog up, what's going to happen to that tissue to stay alive? It will die, right? And if that tissue dies, what's going to happen when the high pressure gets in there? Aortic aneurysm, right? And you probably won't live through it if it's a major problem. So kind of put all these things together. It's kind of neat, right? And still the leading cause of death worldwide, actually, cardiac failure, right? And a lot of it has to do with plaque buildup or some coronary problems that occur. Okay, so to kind of go through the flow system and understand general flow through the circulatory system, oh my gosh, another math equation, right? Math phobia and all that. Is this a new equation? No. Remember, did anybody get that tattoo for the 10 points extra credit? I'm joking. Ohm's law, I equals V over R. Remember that for the neurons that we talked about? I equals V over R? This is no different. I, current, right? V equal, you know, I equals V over R, voltage over resistance, right? We talked about fire hose and garden hose for the nervous system. Well, this is the same equation, basically. Flow, Q, delta P is like the voltage, you know, the change in the pressure, and then resistance. So it's basically Ohm's law all over again, but for flow. So, you know, it all fits together. It's pretty neat. So what causes the pressure difference? Well, that's the pressure difference from, say, one end to the other end. And the point here is that if you looked at this figure right here, 90 to 10, that's 80 millimeters of mercury, right? And if you were at a higher pressure, 180 to 100, that's still 80 millimeters of mercury. So has flow changed at all? No. If the resistance is the same, flow is the same, but you're working in a much higher pressure system, more likely to pop some blood vessels, right? So it's kind of interesting if the resistance isn't changing, but you're at a higher pressure system, but the delta is the same, your flow doesn't change. But the a major factor to change flow is resistance. So let's go through this real well. We can go through some of these. I've put these different. When you stand up in the morning, right, and you're saying, hey, I'm late to 350, can't be late, right, and you stand up really fast, anybody ever black out, like just one, two steps, right? You know, it happens, and you think, just wait a second, I'll get my coffee in a minute, right? And then it all comes back to you. What's happening there? You stand up really quick. What happens to your blood pressure? It drops, but where is it dropping from? Your brain, right? And that's why you black out. And then what's kicking in? What measures blood pressure? Carotid sinuses, right? That low blood pressure, so they kick in. They say, "Uh-oh, we gotta get your blood pressure back up." So what's gonna happen? How do you get blood pressure back up? The neurons in the carotid sinuses are going to the brain saying, hey, you got a problem down there, right? We need to increase this pressure. How are we going to do this? One, increase heart rate. Two, increase the blood pressure. How are we going to do that? Sympathetic response down to arterioles, vasoconstrict, raises back pressure, right? And what else? Maybe a little bit of increase in stroke volume, right? That could be interesting. I mean, you know, with contractility on the heart, the inotropic. So then it goes back up. And this is a common type of clinical test that's done in people that black out often when they stand up. Do they have a good response? So you might have heard of grandma or somebody that might be blacking out, and what they have them do is sit on the edge of the bed, put this thermometer cup on them, and then monitor heart rate. They should be doing that on the other hand, but sometimes they forget to do that. Monitor heart rate at the same time. And so they have them sit down, stand up, sit down, stand up, sit down, stand up. And because right when you stand up, your heart rate should increase just a little bit for a few beats. You'll see a few beats that it's faster. And then it slows down, and that makes sure that you have a normal response to that drop in blood pressure. So that happens with all of us. Of course, they always use this giraffe example because they have such a long neck, and right, they drink down for water, and then they have to raise their head back up, and you can imagine the pressure differences to their brain. They actually have little valves, which we don't have valves in our blood in our veins to keep blood flow going one direction in our head, because we're usually always upright. But these animals, it's quite interesting, they can have valves in their veins to make sure blood goes one direction. So on that resistance formula up here, you think, oh gosh, another formula. People that have taken Kaplan, or you're studying that, that equation's up there, right? And so I want you to at least to be aware of this, not just for pre-med students or pre-dent students, but generally for comparative physiology as well. It's really important. So R is this resistance in the equation up here. What makes up the resistance in the circulatory system? Well, the resistance, remember the Lance Armstrong problem that we had, right? Injecting erythropoietin, increasing red blood cell count. What's that going to do to the viscosity? It's going to really increase viscosity, right? And then what's that mean for resistance of flow? It's going to increase. So you see that that kind of makes sense here, that this N, this viscosity, is directly proportional to resistance, right? Directly proportional. But what about the garden hose and fire hose analogy? If we have the garden hose, it's really constricted, right? You don't get good flow through it. You get the fire hose, you got great flow through it. So what's the relationship there? The radius or the diameter of that. But think of the radius, because this is what's usually in the equations. You could calculate it differently. So the radius is inversely proportional. If we have a fire hose, we've got a bigger radius, right? So it's inversely proportional, and it appears on standardized exams, too, that it's to the fourth power. So what? How does this relate to all this? And this pi is pi, you know, geometric pi. And then L is the length of the vessel we're talking about. And it's just a factor, a fudge factor. Really, it kind of varies depending on the capillary bed or the arterial bed we're talking about. But in general, this fits. Okay, so why this fourth power? Well, if E increases the diameter of the blood vessel only two times, what does that do to the resistance? Remember the resistance right here. Inversely proportional to the fourth power. It decreases it by 1/16, right? Because it's the fourth power. Don't freak out if you ever get that on standardized exams. It's the fourth power, right? It's just like, let's say, 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, right? It's not a it's not an addition, it's a multiplication, right? So just that you remember and you haven't forgotten that basic thing. Okay, so to the fourth power, inversely proportional to resistance. But remember, on some old exams, I don't know if it's on your test bank or not, one of the faculty members in the past used to torture some students and give them numbers and have them work it out, and they would then get this number, but the question really had to do with flow, so you had to go back and figure out the pressure difference too. But in case you're looking at some old exams, that might be in there, but I'm not doing that torturing for you. But some, you know, other types of the torture. Okay. So we got that. What does pressure help to do? You know, movement of legs like spiders, to jump, right? Ultrafiltration, we'll talk about this when we get to the renal system. About this is really important because the kidneys can't function without a certain amount of pressure, and actually the kidneys will go into acute renal failure if it drops. I think the magic number is 40 millimeters of mercury. If systole drops below that, your kidneys will probably die, and then you go into acute renal failure. Also for, you know, reproductive purposes. And then some animals use this for other aspects, like this crazy little animal that they show in lots of comparative physiology books. A little snout comes out with blood pressure. And some invertebrates use that to burrow into the ground, for example. So some general ideas. We've talked about hearts before a little bit, neurogenic and myogenic. What type of heart do we have? Are we a neurogenic heart or a myogenic heart? We are a myogenic heart because our heart can beat without the nervous system. What if we cut the nerves to the heart and you're at rest? Would your heart speed up or slow down? Speed up, because you generally have vagal tone, right, that suppresses heart rate. So if you cut both the sympathetic and parasympathetic, usually your heart will speed up in beating. So you're usually having some suppression. So that's kind of neat to think about. So we have a myogenic heart, but the nervous system can change it, right? Some invertebrates are neurogenic, like your favorite animal, the crayfish. Every beat is controlled by the nervous system. If you cut the nerve, it stops beating, right? So it's very susceptible to that. So neurogenic, myogenic, that's the main points we're getting out here. with feeding. And if we think about invertebrates, it's a misconception that commonly happens until you take a comparative physics course, is that you think open circulatory system means it just has a heart and it bumps and all the blood goes over the whole animal, right? That it can't control blood flow. But in invertebrates, you can control blood flow very well. Like this is a good example. They injected latex dye into the heart of the crab and then let the latex go into all the blood vessels, kill the animal, and then you dissolve all the cuticle and muscle with nitric acid, and then you're left with the skeleton of the blood system. And what you see here is very detailed gills. So the gills actually have an artery that goes to it, capillary beds, in a venous return back to the heart. So it's like its own little closed system, right? And this is an invertebrate. You think open circulatory system, right? So it actually has blood flow that goes through capillary beds and comes back. And the gills are like your lungs, right? Oxygenation back and forth, but also can get rid of waste products and things like this too, CO2. But now you see the blood vessels that go down to the legs, and that's like the claw up there, and you see fine little blood vessels up there too. But those are blunt, open-ending arterioles. They just open up, and then blood just goes out, and then it comes back in the open part of the leg, back into the body cavity, the hemocele. And then those holes in the heart we talked about, osti, they have little holes in the heart. Blood can just fuse in, and when the heart contracts, it closes the osti and forces blood out. Even invertebrates can control blood flow to different organs, like for the GI system. When they eat, they get an increase in blood flow to their GI system. So they can actually regulate blood flow just like you do, right? So it's kind of interesting to think about on the comparative aspect. All right, and then we could spend all the time, you know, just by looking at the crayfish picture and just kind of amaze ourselves with it. But we'll move on. All right. So if we talk about chambers on a comparative aspect, we need to think about this. So fish have atria and a ventricle, so two chambers. Why do we have an atria again? What does the atria do? Just primes the big pump, that's all, right? It's to prime the big pump so it will work efficiently with a full load of blood. And then we get to amphibians. You have a three-chambered heart, two atria and a ventricle. What's interesting about these is that these atria can contract and push blood in the ventricle, but the septum in the ventricle can actually kind of move one side to the other side to push blood more for respiratory function or maybe out more to the systemic function. So it's really kind of interesting. I don't want you to have to worry about some of these differences, but it can kind of flip back. And what you usually see from the hearts throughout the animal kingdom is the first tissue that's perfused is what? The respiratory system, like our heart. First, the respiratory system to get the oxygenation in the blood before it goes out to the systemic circulation. That makes sense, right? So that's kind of neat. And so generally, you know, to the gills, to the lungs, whatever you're talking about, then out to the animal. And that's like the frog. There are some really interesting animals called lungfish. And some textbooks, it depends which one you're reading or things, or you've looked at old exams, the faculty member that we had here, he retired, but he used to make a big thing about African lungfish and Australian lungfish. So the old exams might have that in there. I'm not making a big deal about it. But just that you've heard that there's two different types. They're actually different anatomically, the way they work, but there's a lot of mystery with the lungfish. And the reason is that the African lungfish, there's a lot of folklore that goes along with it. So you can imagine when it's a rainy season, the ponds are full. The fish are swimming around, they're using their gills. Uh-oh, now comes dry season. So what happens? The fish burrow down in the mud. They secrete this mucus layer around them, but they're buried in the mud. And now they're moist, but they're using their lungs to breathe. That's pretty cool. So what happens with the farmer? The farmer says, I want to now plant my crop. You know, the rain's gone. This is rich soil. So they start digging the ground, and all of a sudden these fish come flopping out of the ground without any water. Life must be created out of the ground, right? So a lot of folklore has come from the African lungfish. But we know what this is due to. But it's really quite interesting that they do have gills and they have lungs, and they can switch between these depending on their need. And the Australian lungfish is a bit different in the whole anatomy, so you think they evolve different pathways to get to this point. But it's pretty neat. They're probably going to go extinct in time because of the farming and everything else. But it was neat while they lasted. Okay, then we get to reptiles. Again, they're three-chambered, but this is the key point. The crocodiles are that really kind of stage where you see the true four-chambered heart, two atria and two ventricles. But there's differences among the crocodiles, too, among the types of crocodiles. But what's really interesting in crocodiles, they go underwater for a long period of time. They can hold their breath much longer than we can, and this is why sometimes if they grab a prey, like, you remember that crazy situation that happened with that Disneyland where they got that kid, and then they realized that probably that alligator, the kid's gone, because the alligators can hold their breath for so long, they can pull them underwater. It's not that they chewed them up. They just hold them underwater and drown their prey, basically. But they had this really neat ability to actually switch the blood flow from their lungs to their systemic circulation. And what they can do is actually right here. They can shunt blood. I just want you to think about, well, let's just, it might be easier to talk about it. They have a right ventricle and a left ventricle. And that right ventricle not only has a pulmonary artery that goes out, but they actually have a, what's called a left aorta. They have an aorta that can go out as well. So they have these two major blood vessels that go out of the right ventricle. And on the left ventricle, they got the one major one that we're kind of familiar with. But that left aorta has a branch that goes over to the other aorta, so to bypass the lungs. They don't need to perfuse the lungs if it's, you just need a little bit of keep the oxygenation going. So they have what this is called the foramen of Pannazzi, if I never pronounce it right, Pannazzi, and they can shunt blood over. Guess what? We have something just like that, and we'll talk about that in just a minute.
I was wondering, why does it affect the sympathetic response? Because wouldn't that cause more oxygen to be used? And
so, you mean for in the alligator? Or something?
Yeah, in the crocodile.
Okay.
Isn't it like the sympathetic causes more oxygen to be used, more blood's pumping?
Yeah,
and it would cause it to not be able to hold its breath as long.
That's a good point. So we'll come to some of that later on at the end of this course. But like the sympathetic, if you were having a sympathetic response, and, you know, like, hey, predators around me, right? And you're going to use up more oxygenation. Diving animals are amazing. They can actually have metabolism that goes on and actually handle a much lower pH than non-diving animals, like iguanas and diving birds. Their pH can go way down. But they actually, a lot of the diving animals for a long dive, they actually have a higher hematocrit than non-diving animals, or non-ones that hold their breath for a long period of time. So they have other compensatory type of mechanisms, okay, adaptation. So it's really quite interesting. But I wouldn't get too crazy until we get to the next stage. Okay? So the main point is that they can shift blood from the bypass the lungs. So let's look at us, for example. And some of the aspects to in development. So when you were a little fetus, a long time ago, right, much longer for me, that you were in the mother's belly, where was your oxygenation coming from? Did you have lungs yet? No, right? From the placenta, right? And it's not an exchange of blood from the mother to the infant, right? Separate blood circulation. But you were getting blood from your mother. And let's go through this a little bit, and we'll jump around. So here's the placenta, and blood is coming to the arteries and veins, right? Veins go to the heart. So now we have a vein coming from the placenta going to the heart, but this vein is highly oxygenated, right? So when you get these questions, are veins highly oxygenated? Well, you say, well, it depends, right? Veins are not always low oxygenation. What's another example in you as an adult where the vein is probably the most highly oxygenated part of your circulatory system? Pulmonary vein, right? After the lungs, it's going to the heart. Anything to the heart's a vein, so the pulmonary vein. Now, in a fetus, it's going to be the vein that comes into the right atrium. That's kind of odd to think about, right? So that vein going to the right atrium is highly oxygenated in a fetus. But not only that, the fetus lung takes time to develop. It's slower develop. You probably heard of babies, preemies that are born have a lung problem. They have to put them in an incubator. They worry about surfactant. They worry about the lungs not developed. You ever hear of a blue baby? All right, a blue baby. It's not royalty, blue blood. Sorry. But blue babies. So maybe their lips are blue, their face is blue. They're not getting good oxygenation. Why is it a blue baby? Well, there's something really interesting if in the fetal development, it's like the crocodile, you don't need to perfuse the lungs. Your lungs are still developing. They're not getting oxygenation yet. So let's bypass the lungs. How do we bypass the lungs? Two mechanisms for fetus. If you look between the two atria, right atrium and left atrium, there's actually a septum there. There's a hole in the development. And blood can go from the right atrium to the left atrium. That's pretty cool. But this is sometimes the cause of blue babies. So they can quickly check on a blue baby what the problem might be. Is it this little septal defect or is it something else? One, if it's a septal defect, sometimes they can move the baby around the right way. And it's this little flap. All they have to do is just basically get that flap to touch the muscle and it will close. So sometimes they actually have to catheterize the infant and they put a catheter in and they just push, get into the right side of the heart, right ventricle, or right atrium, and they just push on that little flap until it actually touches the other muscle and then it will just seal up.
For my niece, I guess most babies are born still a little.
You can have it, right, right. Depends on.
Yeah, they turns out that she doesn't have any septum. There.
Okay.
And so she's got to get open heart surgery to
close it up.
Yeah, to close it up. Yeah. Which usually they can do through a catheter, but if you don't have any septum, there's nothing.
Can't do
there's
it.
No flap.
Right, exactly. So we'll come to some of these disorders in a little bit. And there's lots of developmental issues. You can go online. There's some really nice stages in human heart development. It shows how the heart moves around to develop those walls and to make flaps between the atrium and between the ventricle. And it's the way of this blood vessel folding around itself in embryogenesis. Really an amazing thing. But because of all the movements and all the connections, there's many defects that can go on with heart development. So the other aspect is between the pulmonary artery and the aorta, right? Pulmonary artery is going to the lungs and the aorta out to the systemic. You actually are like the little crocodile. You have a blood vessel that goes from the pulmonary artery over to the aorta. It's called the ductus arteriosus as a fetus. You hope it closes when you're born because you want your lungs, right? And when you're born is when you get that high oxygenation in your lungs. It triggers a prostaglandin to actually then help to close the ductus arteriosus. So, you know, usually you close it up quickly, and sometimes it doesn't close that fast, and you have to watch out. So that's kind of interesting. If you look at the circulation as a fetal development, you're just like a fish, actually. You have six gill arches. You have six gill arches that go off both sides, parallel sides, and then some of them close off. You, as adults right now, they're just leftover ligaments, actually, and you could see those. Those ligaments are left in you. And now you see these ligaments, these kind of structures right here. These are the ligaments that are left over. Well, one of those gill arches actually makes the aorta. I think it's this one, you know, that makes off the aorta right here. And you can go back to this crazy table that I got here. It explains everything. The fourth one is the aorta, you know. But you have parallel gill arches off both sides. Anybody ever hear of somebody with an aorta that, where's your aorta normally come off of? Right? Left side? On the left side. But there are people where the aorta comes off on the right side. And they live perfectly fine. Sometimes they don't even know it until maybe they had to get a health check or maybe coronary artery problems. And then they image and they say, whoa, where's the aorta? And then they realize, oh, this is the abnormality. It's common enough that people are aware of it, right? And it can go off the right side, and that's pretty cool. And it's just a developmental issue. It's no biggie. Where did it go to? It depends on which gill arch. This other gill arch, the sixth one right here, is the ductus arteriosus that goes across. But when you're born, it needs to close down. But if it doesn't, it's a problem. Okay. So that's that circulation that we just talked about, bypassing foramen ovale between the two atria, ductus arteriosus between the pulmonary artery and the aorta to bypass the lungs. That's the whole point here, bypassing the lungs as you develop, right? Okay. Pretty neat. You can listen to the heart sounds. They're so cool. You can get online. There's so many websites with heart sounds and abnormalities like the swoosh things and all these other aspects. If you're bored in the summer and you just want to listen to heart sounds, and you know, it's kind of cool. Yeah, keeps you going. Okay? I bring this up about endomethacin because it's a prostaglandin. When, say, a mother is going to have a child, right? They might have swelling in their legs and the joint pains and things like that. So what are you going to take? Some pain medication, right? What kind of pain medication? Maybe one for joint pains. Maybe you're going to take indomethacin. But guess what? It inhibits the prostaglandins. So that fetus is now getting the indomethacin. It's going to screw around with the response to the oxygenation that they're going to get when they're born, that fetus. So now it's not going to respond well. It's going to keep a patent ductus arteriosus. So this is a major problem. That's why you need prenatal care really well, and actually have somebody to tell you not to be taking indomethacin when you have a fetal development, for example. But this still happens all the time because people take medications without thinking about what the causes might be. So what's really interesting about this, this is like patent ductus arteriosus, you don't have to memorize a lot of this, but it's kind of interesting on a cultural aspect. Machu Picchu, right? That's in where? Peru? Right? High altitude. They actually, the indigenous people that live high altitude right now, like in Peru, they actually have something in the South American area in the Andes. The government actually has a program to make sure the indigenous people actually come down more to sea level, not stay up at high altitude when they give birth, because it's something with the low oxygen content. They keep a patent ductus arteriosus. So they want to come down, they have delivery of their baby, and then they can go back up. And it helps with this whole development. Isn't that kind of neat? It's really cool to think about the whole cultural aspect with this as well. And that oxygenation is the key. We'll get to respiration in the next torturing cycle, okay? All right, so it's kind of neat. Heart rates are so cool because, you know, the fetal development, if you hear two hearts, usually this is how they can tell development. Before they had echocardiogram, they actually listened to the heart rate of the fetus and they could tell developmental cycle early on. And it's amazing. Look, 185 beats a minute. Wow, that thing's like a little hummingbird, right? You know, 185 beats a minute. Think of the energy. So in the mother, you know, 70 beats a minute. So you hear those two heart rates, you can tell. Actually, there's, and I don't want you to memorize this kind of thing, but they can actually tell days and age pretty much of the fetal development by the heart rate, seeing if it's normally developed. And this is the kind, I mean, that's like a 10,000 people nearly almost. And you can see that they've really got a nice standardized type of graph for development of the heartbeat.
So I know I've always heard that wives felt like if the heart rate's faster, it's one gender and a fetus versus another. Is there any correlation?
I think they've kind of say it doesn't really happen so much. And it, but, you know, there are always half-truths to everything, right? And maybe the mother had caffeine, and who knows? Lots of things that go on with the whole thing. There might be something to it, you know. Who knows? But there are some interesting aspects. I think I'd wait for the ultrasound. All right, so, and there, like we just were talking about, there's a lots of heart defects. I don't want you to have to memorize these, but you can imagine, look, there's just tons of these things. A lot of the problems that you get are, if there's one developmental disorder, there's usually some other developmental disorders. We have two faculty members in biology that study coloboma formation in zebrafish, basically, how the eye develops and the iris has a little messed up iris. You know, coloboma, but then they have some other problems with their heart not developing right. So if there's some genetic defect and not making one protein or collagen or something that's just not right, that could just mess up many other things. Common problems that you see in children, some of the most common ones are like this tetralogy of Fallot, like four different things that occur. It's really like standard problems that happen. And now they've got it down to where these developmental problems are. Stenosis, or like what you said, maybe the septum doesn't develop right. Other problems, ventricular septal defects are a big problem. And when that happens, that's usually not so great. Here at UK, when there's a problem at UK with some of these children, they don't. Some of the surgeries aren't done here. They actually fly them to Cincinnati. So they're done to Cincinnati, or actually in Kosar in Louisville. So we don't even have, you know, the surgery teams for some of these kind of conditions that go on. They go on to the Children's Hospital in Cincinnati to be worked on. My wife's a nurse in the at Central Baptist for mother and baby. She's been there for 20 years now. Now she's a unit coordinator. But they get these problems often, and sometimes more often than you would like. And a lot of times it can happen with people taking medications or illegal medications too. Not medications, but illegal substances. And this can cause problems as well. So here's atrial, like what you were saying, atrial septal defects, you know. But it's pretty neat. Some of these, you know, how they problems. This tetralogy is four different things, really quite interesting. The stenosis, the aorta doesn't develop right. You see the septum didn't develop right from the ventricle. And sometimes they can correct these, but you can imagine if the left heart doesn't develop, even there's not much they can do. You know, they give a heart transplant. What animal would they use for a heart transplant? They used to use them more often, and now it's really expensive.
Pardon?
A pig for valves a lot of times, but they use baboon hearts. A baboon heart is about the size of your heart, and they'll put a baboon heart in you until they can get a donor heart. Now it's more or less these artificial hearts that are pumping for you, right? And sometimes outside of your body even. And my daughter's a PT, and she works at Children's Hospital, physical therapist at Children's Hospital in Cincinnati. And she had to ambulate or walk a patient, a child, the other day. And she said their heart, their mechanical heart is sitting outside of them, but they have to make sure that they move so their muscles don't atrophy. And they said they're holding this mechanical heart that's strapped around them, but they're actually walking this child. And they think, oh, God, if somebody tripped, you know, she's kind of nervous about the whole thing. But it's interesting what they can do with these. Louisville was well known for making artificial valves, mechanical valves. It actually was put on, the world, stage, actually. The problem with some of the mechanical valves is what do they do? They damage the red blood cells. So they're trying to make better mechanical valves that don't damage red blood cells. This is why they use, like this gentleman mentioned, pig valves. Because the pig valves are actually very similar and they fit about the same size as us. It's interesting because there's some cultural problems with using pig valves. I think there was a number of years back that was actually interesting that the king of Saudi Arabia, the past king that died, the past king actually had a pig valve in his heart because he had cardiac problems, and he went to London to get that valve done, but they kind of hushed it up because the cultural problems. Okay, EKGs, common problems that can happen. We've talked about EKG electrocardiograms. SIDS. They think some of the cases of SIDS are actually cardiac issues of ion channels not working right, and that could be cardiac problems in the heart, and it usually is referred to also with overheating in the infant. There's usually a case too with SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. There's still a lot of unknowns with this, but a lot of these problems, when they have recorded, they've recorded these hearts when they're born, and then they die of SIDS, and they realize they already had a cardiac problem. Okay, so think about all those things in the heart, right? Calcium, sodium channels, potassium channels, contractility, pumps, buffers, all those proteins, every protein, all the mitochondria, all the electron transport chain, TCA cycle, glycolysis, every one of those proteins could have a mutation, right? Wow, amazing that we're even alive, right? So just think about all those problems. You don't have to memorize this kind of stuff, but in development, there is something that's really interesting. All these channels have different expression levels in how they actually start a pacemaker. Think about how to start a pacemaker. That's pretty neat. But it's all these channels that express at different times and different levels in different parts of the heart. And then if those go amok, remember we've told you about a third to 50% of all fertilizations end up in spontaneous abortions. Not induced, it's just spontaneous because of usually some kind of ion channel pathology. If the heart doesn't develop, it's not getting the blood out to the rest of the developing fetus, right? So that's not going to develop, and then it doesn't go anywhere. It spontaneously aborts.
What does the ranitidine receptor do?
Oh, that ranitidine receptor? Remember, like skeletal muscle, what happens? Depolarization of the plasma membrane down the tubule. What's that protein that senses that? Down the T-tubule, generally. It has a special name, we're going to be up all night. No.
Digoxin?
No. Dihydropyridine receptor, right? Conformational change senses that depolarization, and that dihydropyridine receptor internally is connected to an internal organelle, which is the SCR, but on the SCR are other proteins called the ranitidine receptors, right? The ranitidine receptor is like the plug to the bathtub inside the cell. It's where the calcium is. So when the ranitidine pulls out in skeletal muscle, right, calcium comes out and allows you to have contraction. In the heart, the ranitidine receptor is really important because it generally leaks calcium, right? It leaks calcium. Remember that whole idea, just to remind you in case we forgot with this? What does uranidine do? Generally, it leaks a little bit of calcium. And then what does that do? It causes... Did you know this? Down? We kind of drew it. It's another idea with the heart. Let's draw the ER here. Uranidine receptor. Right? It's kind of leaking calcium. Remember this? Leaking calcium. No? Yes? Maybe? No? Okay, leaking calcium. And what is this going to do? How does this calcium get out? The idea was some of the actions in the heart for pacing, too, and calcium regulation. This calcium is removed from the NCX, sodium-calcium exchanger. But that sodium that comes in can trigger depolarization of the cell. This is some of the ideas that are out there. So now we can have voltage-gated calcium channels, and so that calcium is going to come into the cell, right, raise the calcium up, just a little bit of calcium going higher. That actually triggers the ranadine receptor to dump out more calcium. So that is called calcium-induced calcium release, in case you ever hear it. Calcium-induced calcium release, CIRCA, calcium-induced calcium release. That, it's an interesting process. So the ranadine can sense this calcium level. At kind of lower levels, it's leaking and can actually cause more calcium to be released if a little calcium goes up. But what is that going to do? That's going to cause more calcium to come out. And so that really raises calcium. Now, this real high calcium is a negative feedback process, to inhibit the ranadine receptor. So now it's not going to release any more calcium. So what's going to happen to the calcium and time in here? Not only is it going to exchange out through this NCX, but you have plasma exchangers, PMC, that pumps calcium out, calcium binding proteins. It's going to get the calcium back down again in time, right? Because the calcium is not being dumped out of the ranadine receptor, at the ER, SER. So if calcium goes down, what happens to the negative feedback? It goes away. So now what's going to happen? The ranadine receptor starts leaking calcium again, and the whole process starts over, right? So this is why that ranadine receptor is so important, right?
Sorry, it was a tangent, but we went through the whole process. So this is really quite neat, you know. So anything that goes wacko, wow. And we talked about how digoxin works in the heart to keep heart beating. So pretty neat. Okay. Anybody that maybe isn't going to medical school or doesn't have time, you got a family, got other things in life going on, but you still want to help in healthcare, I put this up there because this is such a cool job. These echocardiograms, they're not physicians, they're technicians that have learned their skill very well. And what are they doing here? Looking at pediatric problems. And they can actually do so much with echocardiogram today. They can actually look for the septal defects. They can actually tell ejection volume that goes out of the ventricles. They can measure the cardiac output. Right? They can see if the ductus arteriosus, and you don't need any surgeries yet or x-rays, just echocardiogram. Really cool. And they can do so much to look at this. So, and the cardiologist relies on them, because if they don't collect the data right, then you get a whole wrong problem. So primary care, like these people, and the technicians are, you know, where it's all at a lot of the time to get the right things done. So it's kind of neat to think about. Let's get on to a little bit about the circulation, too, and arteries and elastic recoil. The elastin in your arteries, like your aorta, phenomenal, right, if you look at the cross-section. What's not shown here is like the blood vessels that would help perfuse that aorta. But when we think about veins, our arteries, remember, most of your blood is where? Pooled in your veins when you're sitting down. How do you get that to go? If you start to exercise, you start to contract your muscles, right? And that's going to push on those veins and get that mobilized, right? But your aorta is very elastic as well. And this is a key element. And it has a certain name. It's appeared on standardized exams. It's called the Windkessel effect. So the Windkessel effect is your aorta, when the blood pumps in there, let's think about this. You contract your ventricle, blood goes into your aorta. What's going to happen to your aorta? Let's think of the pressure waves. It's going to expand. It has this elasticity. It expands. On old tests, this word was distensibility. We've had people ask that during the exam before. So distensibility, like elasticity, you know, distends, right? Distendability of the aorta.
But because it has a lot of elastin, it can have a recoil back down. So that's called the Windkessel effect. But what does that do to blood pressure? So let's look at the differences. We have a ventricle that contracts. Blood goes into the aorta. It extends. If we had a pressure transducer in there, what are we going to detect? So we're going to detect the pressure goes up, but it distends. And then as pressure goes down, because the valve's closed here, pressure goes down to systemic circulation, it's going to kind of maintain that pressure wave, right? Because it has elastic recoil. Think of the other situation now. We have a steel pipe. Now we have the same pump. We pump the same amount of blood into the steel pipe. What's going to happen to the pressure wave? It can't extend, right? It can't distend. So the pressure is going to do what? Really skyrocket. And there's no elastic recoil. So what happens when the pressure finally goes down here? It's going to bottom out. So what happens with hardening of the arteries, atherosclerosis, right, is that now you're having like a steel pipe. So the pulse pressure, which is a standard measure in healthcare, is a pulse pressure, would be higher or greater with somebody with atherosclerosis, right? Because it's like the steel pipe. Whereas somebody with a healthy aorta, where you have this and maintains the pressure wave, that's what the distensibility of the aorta can do. So this is that mean arterial pressure is maintained. This is a good take-home point. The mean arterial pressure is maintained by the Windkessel effect, the distensibility of the aorta. And to measure mean arterial pressure is this equation here. And this is the equation, another one that's one of those good things for a tattoo. Any kind of tattoo equation, what have we said in the past? Usually that appears again, right? But you can't use the tattoo during the exam. You have to cover it up. All right, so tattoo equation. Mean arterial pressure is equal to the diastolic pressure plus 1/3 of the systolic pressure plus the diastolic pressure. So you take 1/3 of the difference from systole to diastole and add it to the diastolic pressure. That is the mean arterial pressure. And this is maintained primarily through the Windkessel effect to maintain that pressure wave. Now, there's a lot of things that can affect this, right? If you had arterioles that are constricting down below, right, that's going to build up a back pressure, and your mean arterial pressure would be higher, right? So let's look at some of this. So the mean pressure, what people confuse on exams in the past, is they just take systole and diastole, and they take the 50% point. That's not mean arterial pressure, okay? So 1/3 of the difference between these two plus the diastolic pressure. And this is the general equation for mean arterial pressure. There are some subtle differences in the literature, but generally, that's a generally used. But look at that pulse pressure, systole, diastole. So pulse pressure would be much higher in somebody with atherosclerosis than somebody that has a normal aorta. Okay. So where do we get the largest drop in blood pressure? Question that's appeared many times on old exams and standardized exams. And a lot of times people say capillary beds. It's not the capillary bed. It's the arterioles, because that's where you have the smooth muscle that wraps around those, and that's where you have that resistance that causes the big drop in pressure. So arterioles is where you have a big drop. Remember, systemic circulation starts after the heart, right? So large arteries, the aorta, arterioles, capillary beds, veins. Another kind of question, where's the lowest pressure in the closed circulatory system of a mammal? In the systemic circulation, not the heart, right? You've got to think about systemic circulation. So can you ever get low pressure going to high pressure? No. It's always high pressure to low pressure. So if you have a closed system, you got to get high pressure to the low system, right? Low pressure. So it has to be before it goes back to the pump. So it's in the vena cava, the inferior superior vena cava, right before it enters back into the heart, right? People will commonly then choose capillaries as the lowest pressure, but it can't. Then you couldn't get blood out of the capillaries, right? Because it can't go from low to high, right? So the vena cava for the lowest pressure point. But the greatest drop in pressure is through your arterioles. Okay. Some nice pretty pictures of arteries. And vasodilation, vasoconstriction, we kind of talked about, right? Usually you can vasoconstrict because of the sympathetic system, right?
And so sympathetic system causes that vasoconstriction, can cause those blood vessels to contract down. And there's a kind of interesting aspect about, like we talked about with coronary arteries, local vasodilation. What else causes vasodilation that we talked about? If you're exercising skeletal muscle, you want more blood flow to your skeletal muscle, right? What causes the vasodilation? How do you get an increased blood flow to your skeletal muscles? What happens locally, like local factors? What's a byproduct of metabolism? Mitochondria, you know, glucose broken down to glycolysis, TCA cycle, electron transport chain.
Glutamate?
Glutamate? No. That other tattoo? Nobody got the other tattoo, too, for the extra 10 points? Water, right? And CO2. And CO2, what does that do to pH? If you raise CO2, what happens to pH? Does it go up or does it go down?
Drops.
It drops, right? Because of CO2 plus the other equation that you should have the tattoo on, CO2 plus water equals bicarb plus hydrogen ion, right? So the pH drops. That local drop in pH causes vasodilation. If you have all this metabolism going on, what happens to temperature? It goes up. Higher temperature causes vasodilation also. So exercising skeletal muscle is going to get an increase in blood flow by the local regulation that goes on. You know, on a cold day like today, you get out there, your face might become pallor, your hands might turn white, like if you put it in a cold freezer, right? It's vasoconstriction. Cold causes vasoconstriction. That's why if you have like a nosebleed that doesn't stop, you put ice packs on and ice bags and vasoconstrict, right? Kind of interesting. Okay, so those are kind of gee-whizzy aspects. So with this vasoconstriction, think about where would you want to vasoconstrict if you wanted to raise blood pressure? You sure don't want vasoconstriction in your brain, right? And you don't want it in your lungs. So you don't have the receptors. Remember the sympathetic alpha and beta receptors? The alpha receptors for vasoconstriction, beta receptors for vasodilation. So you don't have alpha receptors in the blood vessels in your brain or in your lungs because you don't want to vasoconstrict those. But it's kind of interesting because epinephrine could be released from your adrenal medulla, right? So you have direct innervation versus hormonal. Beta on your skeletal muscles, if you had some, that you can cause vasodilation. And this is what was very confusing. So it's not the transmitter, it's not the hormone, it's the receptors that mediate the processes, right, where they are. All right, so kind of interesting to think about. These kind of diagrams are neat for you to look through just to kind of say, oh, yeah, you know, how can we change this local versus extrinsic regulation? And we've reviewed some of the, you know, blood changes before. So let's go through some of this. Just really quick on some of the capillary beds, what allows the tissue from, if you have in your skeletal muscle, you know, you got to get nutrients to your skeletal muscle, right? So things have to go out of your capillary beds. And you want to get rid of some waste products, so you got to get rid of that too. How do you get rid of that? Let's go through a little bit of the capillary bed situation. So you actually have pores that can allow ions and water and glucose to go out, right, in capillary beds. And these are like continuous capillary beds, like in skeletal muscle. And they have little pores. But you don't want to dump everything out into your interstitium, right, because you'd get edema, too much edema. So you have these kind of, allowing things, gases freely diffuse across the membrane. Okay, we talked about CO2 already. And, you know, the velocity of blood is very slow in the capillary beds because it's all slowed down. We've talked about CO2 and glucose, kind of, gee whiz, just kind of giving you the idea. Remember, the arterioles have the smooth muscles that wrap around them, like little snakes that can vasoconstrict. Like when you're eating food, you increase your blood flow to your GI tract, but if you exercise, you increase blood flow to your skeletal muscle, right? You decrease it to your GI tract. So this whole idea. So this is kind of a nice figure to think about. Look at that top figure. It's straight across, right? The amount of total flow isn't any different in any part of that circulation because it has to go back around, right? But if you look at the total cross-sectional area, total means all the capillary beds. It's really high, right, for capillary beds, cross-sectional area, because you have so many capillary beds. And then you think about the velocity of blood flow, it's the lowest in the capillary beds, right? But it picks back up as all those come back together in the veins. Okay. So what regulates the fluid to go out to the interstitium or the nutrients to go out? Now, it depends on the textbook you might have and different figures, and it actually does depend on which tissue bed you're talking about. But in general,
in general then, and this has appeared on standardized exams too, so this is something the arterial side of your capillary bed and the venous side of your capillary bed. So what regulates the filtration? What regulates the fluid to get into the interstitium? Hydrostatic pressure is the main part on the arterial side. It's really high. It's going to be pushing stuff out, right? Pushing stuff out. Now, in some textbooks, like this figure here, it shows the osmotic gradient doesn't change. But in some textbooks, it shows it does change. It depends on the tissue. So this high is called onychonic pressure. It's like osmotic pressure. Let's think about water going out, some salts leaving. What's left? Proteins, pretty high, right? So proteins build up. What happens to osmotic pressure? It's going to be increased. Osmolarity increases. So in some textbooks, I just want you to think about it. It depends where you might read. You're going to see the onychonic pressure to change. It might go up on the venous side. But in this diagram, and lots of them, they show it doesn't change because it's so small of a change. The main point is that as you go through the capillary bed, the pressure has dropped so much, the hydrostatic pressure has dropped so much that it's lower than the onychonic or osmotic pressure, if you will. The onychonic pressure is what they call this. It's lower than the osmotic pressure. So what happens to the fluid flow? Well, it now causes reabsorption on the venous side, and it's primarily due to onychonic pressure. People get confused. They're going to say, no, it's due to hydrostatic pressure. It's due to the drop in hydrostatic pressure, right, because it's dropped so low, and there's very little hydrostatic pressure in the interstitium. So things to remember, arterial side of the capillary bed, filtration is primarily due to hydrostatic pressure. As you get to the venous side of the capillary bed, reabsorption occurs, and it's mostly due to onychonic pressure pulling fluid into the capillary bed. Okay? So where does all that excess fluid go that's out in the interstitium? All that excess flow goes into the lymphatic system. You don't want... It's not all being reabsorbed in the capillary bed. It is reabsorbed back into the circulatory system through the lymphatic system. So what's the lymph system? The lymph is really quite cool, and we don't spend enough time about it. If you remember a long time ago when we first started circulation, we talked about some fish have a lymph heart. They actually have a heart inside the lymph system to pump lymph to keep it mixing back with the circulatory system. So the lymph is really quite interesting. It has these like little flaps, these lymph vessels, and people didn't know it was even there, you know, for a long time until they discovered it was kind of cool. And that can get fluid to come into the lymph system, and then it moves pretty much with muscle contraction in your legs and muscles, but also the lymph vessels are close to your arteries, and actually the pulsing of your artery helps with the lymph flow. That's pretty cool, too. But when you have atherosclerosis, what's going to happen? You don't get the big effect. So you can see a real lots of issues with these kind of things. So it's pretty neat because it takes away that extra fluid that builds up, but what else does the lymph system do for us? Do we need a lymph system? What do your lymph glands do in your neck and around your face and under your arms and your groin area? What does the lymphatic system do? Remember the spleen? We talked about that spleen case, right? Where the asplenic patient ended up over here and, you know, they missed it. It was really bad because the person nearly died from it. Because if you don't have a spleen, that's a major aspect for your white blood cells to make white blood cells, lymphatic, your immune system, right? So the lymph glands help you with making antibodies to fight foreign infections. So if you have made a cut in your skin and in your tissue, well, what's going to happen? They're going to be taken up. That bacteria is going to be taken up into your lymph system, and then it goes past your lymph glands, and then the lymph glands, those cells in there say, oh, this is a foreign substance. We need to work on making, you know, a response to this. And if you ever take immunology, great course. Anybody take immunology yet? Yeah, great, right? Lots of different things. Probably talked about the lymph system. Hard course, but neat stuff to it, right? Okay, so lymph. And then where does all this lymph go? If it gets in the lymph glands, it actually dumps before it enters back in the heart. It dumps back in like where the vena cava comes back to the heart. And so it's getting that fluid mixed back in with the red, with your blood coming back. So what's going to happen to oxygenation there? It's going to be even more deoxygenated, right? Because that lymph is not oxygenated, and it actually drops that oxygenation pretty down. But it's kind of cool, because what's the next system it's going to go to? The lungs. So it all mixes back together, and it, you know, enters back in the circulatory system. I think it's phenomenal. It's really neat. Okay. Enough of that. And if you don't have the lymph system working well, you get this disease called elephantitis. And it's common, like in South America, Africa. It's decreasing because they have mosquito control, but it can cause some real problems. There's National Geographic things where people are walking around with a wheelbarrow with a scrotum or a lymph system to draining any of the tissue where lymph is really important. And in pregnancy, for the breast, this is important too, to have a good lymph flow system working. But it's all due to this little parasite that gets in there from these mosquitoes and blocks the lymph glands. And now you see how important the lymph system really is. So going through some of these capillary beds, different tissue types, continuous is where? Like in a skeletal muscle, right? Because you don't want big molecules to go across. And then you get to places where you want some good filtration fluid to go through, like in your kidneys, right? You got to get urine out, right? You did the urine lab, and you can have some things in your urine, but you don't get big red blood cells in your urine. You shouldn't be getting that, right? But then how do red blood cells get into your circulation? Where are red blood cells made? Where are red blood cells? Bones. Which kind of bones?
Lung bones,
like your ribs too, right? So if you have rib damage or you get hit, you can decrease your red blood cell count. But how do you get those blood, how do you get the RBCs into the circulation? This way. You have big gaps. You have sinusoidal capillaries. The sinusoidal capillaries are big enough that RBCs can get into your circulatory system. Okay? So these are kind of important things to think about. So we talked about all this. These kind of tables are just in there to help you to pull it together a little bit. And we've talked about movement and blood flow. These tables, they're just kind of, if you want to look through those, it kind of makes you think about multiple aspects to go on. This is more or less for an open response type of questions, you know, to think about things. But it's important to think about homeostasis regulations, right? Like we talked about, if you cut an artery, what would happen, right, to you? Well, how would your body kick in, right, to try to keep blood pressure up? So you can think about these things. So there's like a bit of, and you can go through, let me just, there's one, just one more figure we want to talk about, and you can go kind of through these processes yourself, but exercise. So when you exercise, as we mentioned, increase blood flow to the skeletal muscle, right, because you mobilize it from your veins. You really change much blood flow to your brain? Not that much, right? So blood flow to the brain, here we have 650 milliliters per minute. Really no difference over here. Percents might change based on the whole, but if you're overheating and you want to get out your heat, dissipate heat, where do you increase blood flow to the skin, right, to get out flow? But you don't need to be digesting food when you're exercising, so you decrease blood flow to your GI tract. This is why your mother tells you if you're going to go swimming, you know, if you just ate lunch, you shouldn't be going swimming because you're going to get a stomach cramp because the blood flow doesn't go to your stomach anymore and all that food builds up, right? General wise tale. Okay. And the heart, you know, you can increase your blood flow to your heart with exercise, vasodilation, things like that. But mostly, you're increasing it to the skeletal muscle, some decrease to the bone. Okay, so that should cover all that good stuff. Let's take five. If you want to take a pee break, come back. We can go over old exams. We can do whatever you want for review. Pee break time. All right, I'll stop this and we'll start this again in a minute.